tomorrow. Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
Did the miracle of flight come from a loose, hanging, frayed fish scale? Because that's what evolution asks you to believe. Did, at one time in the ancient aeons of bygone history, a fish have a collision with a rock, a scale hang there loosely with frayed edges, and gradually evolve into a feather? Because that's exactly the way evolution tells the story. Is that believable? Let's ask it another way. Is the Bible completely out of date in the space age? Do lunar landings and space age technology, the computerized technocracy in which we live, replete with miniaturization, with the H-bomb, and all of the acquisition of material knowledge of science that is so awesome to so many people, such as laser rays and chemical and biological warfare, has all of this, all of our accumulation of knowledge, rendered the Bible completely out of date, relegated to a mythological past of a group of bygone sages who screamed for political and social reform during their day? How about this one? Let's try this on for size. An argument was going on between, as the Bible says, the most righteous man of that time. And even the devil couldn't find out what was wrong with this man. He had a particular kind of righteousness that nobody else could spot. It was self-righteousness, and even he himself didn't know what was wrong with him. And when God, as the story goes, in the book of Job, wanted a man whose name was Job to see how little he was and how great God was in comparison, then God, in a sense, began to usher in all of the information about the world, about the solar system, the universe, and creatures that exist on the earth. He said to Job, "Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Tell me if you know so much. Do you know its dimensions, how they were determined, and who did the surveying?" You know, this is fairly scientific because man is still trying to figure out how the world was made. They don't really know what its core consists of. They can only guess. They don't really know whether it's kind of like quicksilver or something that has great elasticity or whether it's very, very hard. They can only measure by earthquake waves, and some of them surface and some of them bounce off a kind of an inner core, and make certain educated guesses about it. It's a fairly up-to-date question. What supports its foundations? And who laid its cornerstone as the morning stars sang together and all the angels shouted for joy? Who decreed the boundaries of the seas when they gushed from the depths? Now, we know that there are underwater springs and rivers, and we know that the water in the rocks is there. We know the world is porous, that it has a water table, even though that water table has been going down a good bit. There's nothing unscientific about that. Who clothed them, that is the mountains, with clouds and thick darkness? What is darkness and what is light? Do we know what light is? The answer is no. Look it up in the encyclopedia if you don't believe me. Science can tell you that there is visible and invisible light. They can tell you that light travels in waves, but they're not sure of that. They began to think that light travels in particles. So a brand new theory comes up that tries to admit both. That light travels in waves, and having wavelength, that's the difference between the pinnacle of one wave to the other, and the frequency is the rate at which that pinnacle passes a certain point. And they know that by bending white light, which is a mixture of all the various colors of light, the spectrum, that it all becomes, isn't it the red is the very highest, and the real purple would be the shortest waves, that it's bent this way, and you see a rainbow as the light is bent and refracted off tiny little droplets of mist, and it's a beautiful sight, but who put that there? Does science put the rainbow there? Did science make light bend the way it does? Does science make light travel the way it does? Or does science only try to find out what it is and how it acts? We have, two kinds of light, let's say, that there is what is called natural light and a light source, mainly the sun. The moon isn't a light source. It's an indirect. It's only a reflection, as we know. But the sun is a light source. You know, even a candle, actually, when you really get down to it, comes from the sun. Because all energy, long ago, the living things such as the ferns and all of the plants and the animals that became buried in the earth at some giant catastrophe, and I've talked about catastrophism, all of them were absorbing energy from the rays, the light of the sun. So really it's right to say that your old kerosene lantern, you know, there's nothing too old-fashioned about that because jet aircraft use kerosene. So that heat, that light, that energy is actually being utilized now when it was stored in this earth, who knows how many thousands, maybe even millions of years ago, by our own sun, which is merely a yellow dwarf. Now, isn't that great? Isn't that scientific? But who put the sun there? And who made those things millions of years ago to grow on the earth? And who made them dependent upon that light, that energy from the sun? And who made them utilize it and store it? And how come the great calamity that caused the seas to rush over the continents and to bury tons, wholesale, of living plants and animals? They're there. Carboniferous deposits are basically non-radioactive, indicating there must have been a thick mantle of clouds that covered the earth, and somehow the ultraviolet rays were being filtered out in the bygone past. Men lived longer, the Bible says. People never have figured out how that can happen. Well, one day we'll look to the Bible and begin to realize that true science and the Bible are not in any kind of conflict, that the two ought to complement each other, that science merely means knowledge. And when a person accumulates knowledge, he's merely looking into that which God has made, and that includes the human mind, body, eye, ear, nose, and every other part of every other living creature that is on this earth. Science didn't make those creatures. Science cannot create a worm, but humankind can create gods in its own image by the millions. Science can't make an egg, and it can't put one back together again once it's been broken, but it can try to create all kinds of false concepts, which evolution is. Which is merely chance with a capital C, nature with a capital N, bowing before an altar and claiming it all happened kind of over a long period of time through chance and accident and the like. It's absolutely ridiculous, and the Bible is up to date, and you can prove it. I've been on a series of programs on seven proofs that God exists. The Bible challenges you to prove whether or not there is a God. And he says, drag out the universe and take a look at it. Look at the rocks under your feet and ask where a raindrop comes from. Where does it come from? Well, out of the sky. But how did it get there? Evaporation. Where from? The ocean. How did the ocean get full? The streams run down to it. All the springs underneath. Who put the ocean there? We didn't. You know, we found a ready-made world when we came into it. We looked around one day and asked Mama what the sun was, or did we? Maybe they told us in the classroom. They didn't do too good a job because that time they didn't even know. But people don't even ask questions like that. Basically, answer this for yourself, if you will. How many times have you ever thought to look up the word all? Some. Nothing. Darkness. Light. Have you ever looked up the word forever? Have you ever looked up the word earth in an encyclopedia? Find out what it is. Hebrew Eretz, which means land, as well as the globe, it means earth, dirt. What is it? What's it composed of? Have you ever just looked up some of these simple definitions like light in an encyclopedia and asked yourself, what is it? Science doesn't know what light really is. It admits now to two possibilities. Maybe it travels like a series of bullets out of a machine gun in particles, and maybe it travels like waves, but they're not really sure. They can only see a little bit about what it does. So here in the book of Job, the challenge to this man was, have you visited the treasuries of the snow? What causes a snowflake to form the way it does? If you've ever been in a black coat in a snowstorm and you're out there where it's pretty cold and it doesn't melt immediately, you will see some of the most intricate designs you could ever remotely imagine. How does all of that happen? Why doesn't it come down just like a blob? Why does it form in certain designs in frost on a window pane or even inside the ice cube tray in your own refrigerator? What makes that a law? Why does that happen immutably, incontrovertibly, every single time, dependably? We didn't make it that way. Science didn't make it that way. Science goes around and hangs labels like people labeling doors, his and hers. Science comes up with a name or a label. We say, isn't science wonderful? But science is only an attempt to come to know that about this material universe, how it operates. But when it comes down to where it came from and why it works that way, science might as well tape its mouth shut because it doesn't know. It just doesn't know. That's where you have to go to the Bible. He said, have you seen where hail is made and stored? You know, some of these giant thunderheads up there, we go within about maybe 25 miles of some of those big ones that go up over 40,000 feet because those anvil heads can be throwing out because they have churning winds inside of them and are cyclonic or circular in form. And they can be throwing for several miles grapefruit-sized balls of hail. Now, this is 50,000 feet up. By the time that drops on down, falling free, it's broken up and disintegrated and melted into all kinds of drops of rain. But literally, there have been big 707s and giant military aircraft that somehow, because of improper radar or inadequate pilot, maybe it was pilot error, maybe some other mistake, but they flew into one of these big thunderheads, these big thunderstorms, and that aircraft was absolutely ripped apart just like it had been shot down with flak. And that's just by giant hail. How does that form? What causes it? Here in the book of Job, he said, I have reserved it for a time when I will need it in war. Where is the path to the distribution point of light? Anything unscientific about that question? Science can't answer it. Where's the home of the east wind? Science still doesn't really know what causes these jet streams and why they act the way they do. Meteorology is still, in one way, an infant science. Who dug the valleys for the torrents of rain? Who laid out the path for the lightning, causing the rain to fall upon the barren deserts so that the parched and barren ground is satisfied with water and tender grass springs up? Has the rain a father? Where does dew come from? Who is the mother of the ice and the frost? That's what the one who is called God in the Bible asked the most righteous man who was alive at that time. And when he had heard it all, when he looked at fire and hail and windstorm and frost and rocks and wild creatures and giant creatures in the sea, when he'd heard the voice of God saying, "Where were you when all this was brought into being?" he finally said, "You know, I've heard a lot about religion. My eye began to conceive in my mind's eye of you. I thought I knew about God. But now," he said, "my eye really sees you. Now I comprehend. Wherefore," Job said, "I abhor myself and repent in sackcloth and ashes." It'd be great if science would do that, too. And then maybe science could get busy and tell people a little bit more about God and less about science. Science is taking the credit to itself, it seems, way too much of the time, and steering people away from God. Well, what about the miracle of flight? Did a loosely hanging frayed scale become a feather? Are the birds that you see flying in the heavens and perching in the trees the closest living relatives to crocodiles?
One question that has bothered man for centuries probably has bothered you too. Average men and great philosophers alike have struggled with this monumental problem, and it's a question that needs answering. The question is, does God exist? And if so, how can you prove it? Whether you feel that organized religion is ritual or reality, the question still remains. The free booklet, Does God Exist?, offers tangible information that will help you answer this timeless question. You'll learn how matter, intelligence, and design prove the literal existence of a creator God. There is no greater question that means so much to your own daily life and peace of mind. Does God exist? Now you can know beyond any doubt. Request your free copy of Does God Exist? Dial this toll-free number, 800-423-4444. That's 800-423-4444.
Birds came from reptiles, according to evolutionists, but did they really? Does that make sense? Let's take a quick look and find out. How could a loosely hanging scale become a feather? Let's be logical. First of all, birds have feathers, that's true, but those feathers molt. All birds change their feathers at least once a year, and some of them three times a year, just like deer will shed their hair, and so will your dog. Deer will shed their antlers, but you know, when you knock a scale off a fish, he can replace it. You can run a fish a couple revolutions to an outboard motor, and he's going to grow some more scales in that place. Snakes and reptiles and lizards molt. They crawl right out of their skins and come up with a brand new one. You know, science really does admit that acquired characteristics are not transmitted on down to the youth. We know that it's a law, an absolute law, that a parent that loses an arm in an accident, and that's a lot worse than just getting a piece of skin knocked loose, as they argue, and I'm going to give you that quote because maybe I better do it right now and interrupt myself, because this is a place, I can hardly believe it, but this is a quotation out of the Bird's Life Nature Library, and it's about a bird's feather. And I quote, "The feather is a marvel of natural engineering. It is at once extremely light and structurally strong, much more versatile than the rigid structure of an aircraft's wing, and far more readily repaired or replaced when damaged. The intricacy of the design that allows this can be appreciated by putting the feather under a microscope. It would be seen that each parallel barb slanting diagonally from the shaft is not hair-like, but appears as a miniature replica of the feather itself." You can see this beautiful picture, and you'll have this in the free brochure you write for. It's free of charge and no price. You'll see this and a lot more like it. So there are numerous smaller side branches or barbules that overlap those of the neighboring barbs and adhering to one pattern. And these in turn have tiny projections called barbicels, many of which are equipped with minute hooks that neatly hold everything in place. Now, the single pigeon feather under scrutiny may have several hundred thousand barbules and millions of barbicels and hooklets. How did this structural marvel evolve? Now let's come down to the point that evolution wants to make. They say, and I'm quoting from this book, "It takes no great stretch of the imagination to envisage a feather as a modified scale, basically like that of a reptile. A longish scale, loosely attached, whose outer edges frayed and spread out until it evolved into a highly complex structure that it is today." That's what our kids are taught in classrooms. That it takes no great stretch of imagination, so immediately your mind's prepared. Now, you're not going to have to sweat over this. Don't worry about it. This won't stretch your imagination a bit. It won't. It does mine. It says like a reptile. So it's not even talking of a fish scale, but more of a reptilian scale, like a piece of armor plating. Or most reptiles crawl right out of their skins and come up with a brand new one. When you hack off a man's arm, perish the thought, he does not give birth, or his wife doesn't, to a child minus an arm. When colonial governments insisted in Africa and other places that certain tribes do not anymore flatten their babies' heads or elongate the women's necks or something like this, the very next babies, the very next generation that were born, and these people may have been doing that, both parents, for thousands of years, and the next kids that were born were just as normal as anybody. The minute they stopped it, you know, this lip distending practice or the nose distending practice. You heard about the Ubangis, didn't you, in the rainforest? The one of them with a great big wooden plaque and the other one, the lip stretched out about like this, and they were standing in the heat, shade of a banyan tree or something, very hot day, about 102. And one of them looked at the other one and says, "Peter Piper picked a peck of pick peppers, now you fan me for a while." Might have been some use for a wooden plaque in somebody's distended lips, but you know, they discontinued that, and I imagine by now it might be very difficult to even find some of these people where these tribal practices have been carried on for thousands of years, but the babies weren't born with flat heads, stretched necks, or distended lips. And Hebrew babies are not born circumcised. And loosely hanging scales do not become feathers. A fish doesn't have a lifespan anywhere near as long as a man's. So if you can go around taking a man's finger off and have him give birth to kids without fingers, that'd be enough. But having become something other than a man? That's really stretching your imagination beyond the absolute breaking point. Science knows better. And to have something in such a prestigious magazine with beautiful full-color pictures about the marvelous intricacy of a bird feather, and then to tell young unsuspecting children, it takes no great stretch of your imagination to envisage a feather as a modified scale hanging there loosely that turned into a feather? How some of this reasoning can masquerade under the title of science is almost beyond anyone's natural ken. What do you mean, no stretch of the imagination? That stretches it clear past the breaking point. So we're asked to believe that feathers, in all the intricate, marvelous different kinds of feathers, for different kinds of birds that do different things for different birds. Birds do all kinds of things. Some of them soar. Some of them migrate over thousands of miles. Some of them have their wings placed far aft and their necks stretched out way ahead, like the geese and the ducks and so on, for long-range fast flight. Others can turn real sharply, so just like you design an airplane to do the same thing, we have to look at birds to get the idea of how to do it. The wings are far forward. Some of them fly backwards, like a hummingbird. Some of them hover, like a hummingbird, and other types can do. And you know, at once, a bird's wing is propeller and flaps and wings and everything. If I told you that a modern jet airplane just kind of put itself together, that a near airplane was lying in a field one day, and the cockpit and the tail section, the fuselage, the engines and nacelles and the props and everything just kind of put themselves together and then began to fly, what would you say to me?
Radio news, papers, magazine,
television.
All report the news, but who really explains it?
Editorial,
documentary,
opinion,
survey.
Indicate trends, but who ties them all together? Plain Truth, the International Journal of Understanding.
Overview,
supplement,
insight.
Plain Truth explains the news. Plain Truth ties trends together. Articles include Personal from the Editor, featuring Herbert W. Armstrong's first-person contact with heads of state around the world. Garner Ted Armstrong's Speaks Out column. Bureau reports, editorial insight, and much more. If you've been looking for an explanation of the news, if you've been trying to tie trends together, request your free subscription to Plain Truth. Join the ranks of over 3 million subscribers who look to Plain Truth for understanding.
Overview.
Supplement.
Insight.
Plain Truth. Dial this toll-free number, 800-423-4444. That's 800-423-4444.
What does it take to fly?
I remember jumping off the roof when I was a kid, holding a great big umbrella. All I did was turn the umbrella inside out and nearly break both legs. I wanted to fly. I used to lie around with my arm around a great big shepherd dog and look up at a big oak tree, and I'd see birds flitting around through there, and every kid, I think, has done that. He's thought, man, what a great sensation it would be to be able to perch on a limb and to fly around like birds do. Well, finally, one day, my dream came true, and I managed to get a trip in a little light aircraft, and I mean, I was smitten with the idea from then on, and I always wanted to fly. Well, finally, I achieved the opportunity to be able to fly and to get my pilot's license to fly all different types of single and twin engine aircraft and then even sophisticated jet aircraft. And it is something that is a very wonderful experience to be able to do. But you know, there is a fantastic series of mechanisms and machinery and avionics and all kinds of parts and things that are going for you in these modern marvels of engineering. The structural framework of these aircraft to make them at the same time light enough and yet resistant enough, rigid enough, yet not too rigid so they don't break up in turbulence, is a mechanical miracle of sorts. An airplane, you know, it took mankind how many thousands of years to get down to the point where it quit playing with kites and began to think. Men used to strap wings and begin to move their arms. They used to run down hills and glide about 2 feet and skid on their nose. And we know the story of the Wright brothers and the Russians and all the Seversky's and Sikorsky's and other people. And finally, we came to the age of flight. Well, the first flight wasn't as long when the Wright brothers took off at their little old first attempt at flying from the tip of one end of a jet aircraft wing to the other. And yet look at us today with these giant super Airbuses going back and forth, and we know that didn't evolve. We know that's the result of intelligent, creative thinking, planning, and aerodynamic design. And we know that that is a computerized technology of a space age where thousands of very intelligent minds have been required to even make little tiny modifications to improve as we gradually go along. America went to war during World War II with aircraft that didn't fly as fast as some of the commercially available twin-engine aircraft of today. The old Brewster Buffalo that was shot down so easily by the Japanese Zeros in the opening rounds of World War II was a ponderous, sluggish old airplane. And so were some of the others. We came along with the Wildcats, and then the Bearcats and Hellcats. The F-4U bought Sikorsky Corsair, the P-39, the P-38 Lightning, the F-47, or P-47, as it was called. Now today they're all obsolete. Then we came up with jets, and they're obsolete. Now we've got supersonic, double sonic, and we're working on 2.5 times the speed of sound swing-wing aircraft. And this evolved. You know, when you look at the structure of an aircraft, you're looking at something man did, and you marvel. It's an amazing thing. I know. I've seen the insides of aircraft, and I've been able to fly aircraft. But when you look at the aerodynamics of bird flight, you're looking at something that is even more marvelous, because you can't explain how that came to be without a mind superior to all the thousands of minds of man, because man cannot build an efficient machine that will do what the body and the wings and the feathers of a bird will do. A bird's body is porous. Porous bird bones. This brochure, if you'll write for it, will give you and your children a picture, a very, very beautiful series of pictures of exactly how the little bird's bones are made. The story of evolution says, among the many engineering accomplishments that birds have achieved, isn't that beautiful language? Birds achieved this, did they? Or did they just happen to be that way? The development and muscular controls of feathers and the structural rigidity and flexibility and precision and agility of their feather and their bone structure stands out as being a very important thing. Feathers provide smooth and streamlined body contours that are essential for the reduction of air friction and turbulence, and when properly groomed are completely waterproof. Isn't that fortunate? Isn't it lovely birds don't sweat, and that feathers are waterproof, and that each little barbule has a barbicelle which then is hooked to the other one next to it? Isn't it beautiful the way it all just happens to be that way? And that birds' bones are porous and have air sections inside of them so they're so lightweight. Here's another story that evolution gives. This is from that same source I gave you earlier. During their evolution, and I'm quoting, from reptiles to their modern form, birds became warm-blooded. Then they needed something other than scales to provide a covering. Because you see, they're standing around shivering, stark naked. They're warm-blooded, but it's cold out there. They're standing there, and a hurricane is underway, and everybody's feet are cramped because they're perching on a limb. And they've crawled laboriously because they haven't flown yet. So they're perching on this limb, and the wind is blowing, and the poor creatures are ice cold. So immediately, boing, you know, pop, They are covered with feathers. It says here that during their evolution from reptiles to modern form, birds became warm-blooded. You can't even do that when your air conditioning system isn't working, or something's happening in reverse of that where you can't get the heater on. Humans don't even change their habits as quickly as evolution claims some of these things were supposed to happen. And I'm not saying it's a matter of whether it took time or not. I'm saying it's utterly ridiculous. It's laughable. It's like comic book stories. It's insane. It doesn't make sense. It can't be proved. There aren't any intermediate species. There aren't any such things as half reptiles and half birds. And it's a story which has been parading under the guise of knowledge that has infused itself and absolutely is found throughout texts on practically any subject that is encountered by your children in school today. There is a concerted effort to put the story of evolution into your child's mind, and he is offered no alternative. This program, then, is going to fill that gap. It's about time God got equal time with science. And this program is talking about there being a God, and I'm offering seven absolute proofs. The first is law requires a lawgiver, and we proved it. The second is life requires a life giver, and we proved that. The third is that there is a creation and that demands a creator, and we prove that. The fourth is that kind comes after kind, life of pre-existing kind, a pre-existing life of the same type. And the fifth one is the one that we're talking about right now, and perhaps one of the most interesting and one of the most easily proved of all, that a great design requires a great designer. I don't care whether you are studying the cleavage properties of minerals, whether you're studying the simplest things you could pick up in the simplest encyclopedia. So far as you being able technically to explain what fire is, what is air, what happens in the sun, things that, after all, we deal with every single day, well, if you just look up the simplest articles in an encyclopedia, you'd get the shock of your life, I imagine. It'd be very, very interesting to you. But if you write for this beautiful, colorful brochure, A Theory for the Birds, you'll see some of that simple household science. You'll see very, very dramatically enlarged pictures of the feathers and wings of a bird. You'll see all the different kinds of beaks that are tools for the bird, for different kinds of birds. The woodpecker, a chisel beak, scooper and strainer beaks, beaks that are designed for banging through wood, or beaks that are designed for pecking insects or whatnot. You'll see pictures, too, of some of the colorful birds that exist, their different food-getting habits, nest-building habits, and the story about migratory birds. And every last one of those things present a very grave difficulty for evolution. It's called A Theory for the Birds. It's a colorful brochure, the same size as the Plain Truth magazine. You ought to write for that as well. The Plain Truth and the brochure on A Theory for the Birds. They are free of charge and there is no price. We'll send it to you by return mail as soon as you dial that toll-free number, 800-423-4444. Or you can write to me, Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California. Until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have heard The World Tomorrow with Garner Ted Armstrong, sponsored by the Worldwide Church of God. For literature offered on this program, send your requests along with the call letters of this station to Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California, 91123. Or you may dial this toll-free number, 800-423-4444.